Hi, I'm Marianne Campbell. Welcome to the second in our series given by Al Stewart at the City Bible Forum. The talks are called Ecclesiastes, An Honest Look at Life. Join me this week as we hear Al speak on the search for meaning.
I'd like to begin by talking to you about a Sydney icon, the Royal Easter Show. When I think of the Royal Easter Show, I think one of my favourite things, actually there's two different images spring to mind. The first one is this man. Does anyone know who this man is? David Foster, the giant from Tasmania. You've got to be quick to catch him chopping a block of wood. It takes about three hits. I've seen him do it. The other one that I like, or that just springs to mind, is of course the clowns, the ping pong balls. Now, I wonder if you've ever taken a little kid to the Easter show. It might be your own kids or nieces and nephews or with someone else's kids. It is absolutely exhausting for a number of reasons. First of all, they have no idea what it costs. They don't know it costs an arm and a leg. They just, let's go, bring it on. Then you have to teach them there's like a million people there and do not talk to strangers and do not wander off or someone will grab you. They don't know that. And then, well, you get there and then there's a sideshow alley. And so it's, quick, can we go, the clowns, everyone wins a prize, the sign says. And there are the giant stuffed animals hanging from the kind of roof. And you feel like saying, oh, mate, or honey, or whatever, you know, whatever you call the kid. And no one wins those things. Win a prize, you pay $5, your prize is 10 cents worth, and those things, they've been there longer than I've been alive, and so on. And even if you did win one, who wants to carry it home? You know who's going to carry it home, don't you? And then it will sit in the corner of your bedroom. It's bigger than you are. You won't want to play with it. You'll be frightened of it. And then it'll sit there for however long until we manage to convince you that we can throw it out. Okay, sideshows. Then the next thing is show bags, and that means queue up in a crowd with a million people, and you queue up, and then you pay a fortune for a show bag that's full of what? Junk. Junk food, junk toys. And you want to say, oh, do you really need it? You'll get home, you'll eat all of this, you'll feel sick, you'll break the toys in 20 minutes. Then they'll sit under the big stuffed animal until we can throw it all out at council cleanup. Strangers, clowns, show bags, and little kids love it. Why? It's because they haven't experienced life enough yet to know that. They haven't been around the block enough times yet to be disillusioned, to realise that no one wins the prize, nothing changes, you can't trust strangers at all. It's not that exciting. The only fun in doing those things as an adult is when you do it with a little kid, because the little kids are still excited about it. Why is it that as most people get older, they get disillusioned? Why is it that we get bored and cynical? And why is it, if I could say, as you get older, it gets harder and harder to get excited about things? It's not just that the body's wearing out. It is that I've done it all before and it's just not that exciting anymore, and so on. We've seen it all before. The new Premier of New South Wales government is sworn in. And wasn't it good? He's going to fix the trains. There won't be any more problems with the trains, right? Yeah, well, those of us who are a bit older think seen it all before, round and round, yada yada, and I wonder whether as we get older, more and more of life seems like sideshows and show bags. And it's just empty and doesn't deliver. What is it that really gives life lasting meaning? Where does meaning and purpose come from in life? Ecclesiastes asks that question again and again. What gives life meaning and purpose? What lasts? What has value? We introduced the book last week and said the author, it may be Solomon, the great king, or it may be someone writing later through Solomon's eyes. Let me just call him Solomon, though. Solomon begins his look for his quest to find meaning and purpose. Have a look at chapter 1, verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. That's his starting point. That's how life appears. So he sets out to try and find something that is meaningful, that gives purpose. And the way he does that, 1 verse 3, is to ask a question. Here's the question. What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? So man, people. The gain word is actually an idea from commerce. It's the idea of what is surplus, what is left over, what is the profit. We might say today, what's the bottom line? What's left? We work and struggle and so on and work so hard. What's left? What's the gain? What's permanent? And notice the little phrase, under the sun. Very important. As far as I can work out, what he means is this. If our world was a closed system, if all we had was our common sense and our eyes, if we look out at what our world looks like under the sun, what do we see? That is, without God speaking to us, without a revelation from God, with nothing supernatural telling us, just how do we make sense of life, the realm of human life under the sun? And what do we see today, as you get to chapter 1, verse 12, is he sets out to try and find something that gives life meaning or purpose. Here's the way it works. If you look at the booklet, from verses 12 to 18, chapter 1, verses 12 to 18, he's talking about gaining wisdom, growing in wisdom. And then he does it twice. 12 and 13, he talks about growing in wisdom, and then there's a little proverb about wisdom. And then 16 and 17 talks about gaining wisdom, and then there's a little proverb. But here's to say, wisdom, in the way that the Hebrews thought, is not just accumulating information. It's not just like an academic exercise in terms of accumulating facts. It's much more an understanding of how do you live. How do you understand life in our world? Well, let's have a look at what he's seen from verse 12. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. Now, what is this great burden that God has put on men? Well, verse 14, he tells us, I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. So is that what life's like? It's a vapour, it's there and then it's gone, and under the sun, it's all just chasing the wind. And then he gives this kind of proverb, verse 15. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. As I've read the scholars, the experts, I think what he's saying here is there's something fundamentally wrong with our world. There are intractable problems that we just can't solve. Does anyone know who said these famous words? I always said there was something fundamentally wrong with the universe. Immortal words spoken by Arthur Dent. Arthur Dent's probably the main character in Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, a trilogy in five parts, as he says. If you know the story, science fiction, they set up the deep thought computer that thinks for, I think it was 7 million years, to work out the answer to life, the universe and everything. And the answer comes up to be, you must know, 42. Well done. So the answer to the life, universe and everything is 42, but then it takes two or three books more to work out what's the question. And it turns out that the question, eventually, long and drawn out, the question is, what is 6 times 9? And the answer is 42. If you're not so good at maths, I worked it out, it's 54. But the answer is 42. It's 54, but 42. And then Arthur Dent says, I've always thought there was something fundamentally wrong with the universe. Douglas Adams is very insightful and clever. And a lot funnier than I just was, okay, if you want to read the book, it's quite good, really. What is twisted cannot be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted. There are things we just can't fix. Why is it, with all of the technology and all of the so-called advancement that we've got, why is it that we can't get rid of greed and selfishness and violence? Why is it that we can't run efficient programs and bureaucracy bogs things down so often? Why is it that in all of the wealth that the Western world's created, it's the wealthiest parts that have the highest suicide rates? What is twisted cannot be straightened. There are some things that we just cannot solve. He continues about wisdom, verse 16. I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. The way to be happy is to study the meaning of life, of course, isn't it? So at university, I remember thinking back, it's the philosophy students that had a great time, yeah? No. The philosophy students always look, with respect if you're a philosopher, but they always look haunted. and kind of carrying around books without pictures that they read, and they just look, you know, they never have a good time. They're thinking about things. They're trying to work out the meaning of life. No. As I went through uni, do you know the people, the students that really enjoyed uni? The engineers and the rugby players. They never thought about anything. They had a great time. Anyway, because Solomon says, verse 18, "For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Why is it that little children are so happy?" Answer, they don't know anything yet. That's why. They haven't learned. They haven't learned. Life hasn't knocked the joy out of them yet. So I think Solomon looks at it and thinks, well, maybe the meaning of life isn't in wisdom. Maybe it's found in pleasure. And what he does in 2 verse 1 is give us a summary statement of his quest to find meaning and purpose in pleasure. So 2 verse 1 is the summary, and then he tells us what he did. 2 verse 1, "I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good." But that also proved to be meaningless. And as he's not saying it's bad, and he's not saying don't have fun. If you understand the meaningless idea, it's a vapour. It doesn't last. It's gone. And he's saying pleasure is meaningless. It's not that you should aim to be miserable, but it doesn't last. I was thinking pleasure is a bit like water in your hands. And that is, you can scoop water onto your face and it's freshening and beautiful. That's pleasure, but you can't hold a handful of water in your hands. It just seeps through. It's fun, but it doesn't last. It's a vapour. It's water through your hands. Or in 2 verse 2, he says, "Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish?" Once again, he's not saying laughter's bad, but just what's the point? It's a great irony in life, that some of the people that have the most insightful and dry senses of humour have it from a sad heart. You know that? The people who are really funny, when you just look behind the humour, there is a heart that's sad. They see life so clearly, and it's great ironies, and are able to show that, and yet there's a sadness there. It's exactly what the book of Proverbs says in the Old Testament. It says, even in laughter, the heart may ache, and joy may end in grief. Laughter is to our lives what shock absorbers are to cars, just trying to make the ride a little more comfortable. It's our way of coping with the ironies and the pain of life. That's his summary. So here's what he did. "I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. So drinking and partying and so on, and it's fun for a while, but have you ever noticed that most people grow out of it? Why? Because after a while it gets boring. Right? And the amount of pain that it brings is not worth the amount. Pleasure versus pain, it's a bad deal in the long run. So maybe it's not in the kind of the hard living. Maybe it's in aesthetics, creating something beautiful and finding it that way. And Solomon certainly had the money and the power to do it. And so he says, 2 verse 4, "I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women, singers, and a harem as well. The delights of the heart of man." Whatever you want, any indulgence you can have, he's enormously rich and the king, he could have it. The history books in the Old Testament that tell the history of the nation of Israel, in the book of 1 Kings, we are told of Solomon, he had 700 wives of royal birth in intermarriage with the other nations around. 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines. All King Solomon's goblets were gold. And all the household articles of the palace of the forest of Lebanon, which is the palace he built for himself, what it was called, were of pure gold. Nothing was made of silver because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's days. The king had a fleet of trading ships at sea, along with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years it returned, carrying gold, silver and ivory and apes and baboons. The history books tell us that Solomon spent 7 years building the temple in Jerusalem and 13 years building his palace. Solomon says, back to Ecclesiastes, he says, "I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labour. Last week we were saying that Ecclesiastes chapter 1 says nothing ever changes. It's all the same. And that is that rich people indulge themselves. So I saved an article from the paper about an architectural firm, John B. Scholes, who builds exorbitant houses for people with too much money. There's one that he built in England, I won't read about it, it only cost $70 million. And then we're told, by American standards, of course, this house in England is at the mean end of the scale. In the USA, it's a country where Larry Ellison takes on Bill Gates for the title of top cheese by building a bigger house than him. Now, here's you dial up Google and there's Bill Gates' house. Bill Gates recently announced that he was extending his $200 million home near Seattle, Washington. Yeah, Bill does have a daughter, I think. He's got a wife and a daughter, so you can see he probably needs a bit more room, actually. It wouldn't be quite big enough, would it? To which Ellison replied with a $300 million Japanese-style mansion in California, twice the size of the White House, and complete with artificial lakes, waterfalls, and 3,800 tonnes of hand-chiselled Chinese granite for the retaining walls. But neither of these guys are really at the top. The world's largest private house is believed to be the New York industrialist's R.A. Rennert's mansion in Fairfield, which is 160 kilometres east of Manhattan, which boasts 29 bedrooms, 42 bathrooms, a 164-seat theatre, two bowling alleys, you need two, and an English-style pub. Now, that's the only photo I could find. I guess that's taken from the front fence, okay? That's the... Anyway. Listen to what this man said about why these people do this. Scholes had described some of the designs for his clients as, quote, Disneyland for adults, in which the joy comes not from playing the rides, but from knowing that you have the money to build them and then neglect them. One house owner incorporated a three-hole putting green. He said, I don't play golf, but everyone says if you have a house like this, you build a green. Enough money to build it and then neglect it. I wonder why Bill Gates and this man Ellison want to extend their homes. Why? I wonder, is it the same reason as when Solomon gets to the end of it all and he looks at it, he says in verse 11, yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Now, I've thought about that a lot. He doesn't argue for it. He doesn't kind of say, for these reasons, or here's the logic of it at all. I think what he's saying is, this was my experience. And you know what? It gels with my experience too, and I suspect with yours. And that is, you look forward to getting something. You know, when I own, what could it be, the new car. Or when I finally get the, whatever that particular article of clothing is that you want. Or when I get the television or the whatever it is, you fill in. And you look forward to it and then you get it and it's great for about 15 minutes and then what? It's kind of ordinary. And what's the next thing? And what's the next thing? And the things you get just don't satisfy. And the new car becomes so ordinary so quickly and wonder what the new model is and so on. And have you noticed people who do extensions, you know, it might take 13 years to do them, the same as Solomon to build his house, but you'd finish the extensions and then it's kind of, what now? And, oh, well, why don't we extend some more? Or we'll sell this place and we'll buy another one. Some people have spent their whole life extending and building, and because if you ever stopped and looked like Solomon did, you'd see it's all just a vapour. It's empty. It's chasing the wind. And what about us? If we're actually lucky enough to have a mortgage, we wouldn't have a house as big as Bill Gates or these other guys. What we would have? Well, we'd have, you know, a little box that we could spend, if we're lucky, our whole lives paying off. And our little box would look pretty significant from a long way away. And, well, if the things that we build, when we actually stop and look, if they don't satisfy, if they just not quite, maybe the answer's in wisdom. And that's where Solomon turns. Wisdom might not be comfortable, but at least it could give meaning and permanence. And 2 verse 12, then I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, like foolishness. Wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in darkness. But I came to realise that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. Here's a quiz for you. What do Albert Einstein, the physicist, Edwin Hubble, the astronomer, William Shockley, the inventor of the transistor, and Bertrand Russell, the mathematician and philosopher, what do they all have in common? They're all white males. They were all actually listed in the Time magazine's summary of the 100 great thinkers and philosophers of the 20th century. But that's not the most thing that they have in common. The most significant common factor is, of course, they are dead. That's right, dead. And for all their learning and all their achievement, they're dead. In exactly the same condition as someone who'd never thought a thought, never read a book, etc. So Bertrand Russell, with all his great learning and philosophy, died and was buried. Douglas Adams, with his humour, his insight, his understanding of life, he died just 2 or 3 years ago as a relatively young man. But he died. And so Solomon says, as he faces up to this, he says, verse 17, "So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." And for all our wisdom and philosophy and the things we learn in the school of hard knocks, our wisdom comes, if you'll excuse the expression, comes to a dead end under the sun. Our learning, our wisdom are just a vapour and they disappear with us. Now, what if there was a wisdom, though, that was from beyond the sun? What if there's a wisdom that is from our Creator? A wisdom that is the answer to the problem in our world. A wisdom that is an answer to the problem with each one of us. What if it was a wisdom that was totally different to what human intelligence and ingenuity would have come up with? What if it was something from completely outside that was given to us? The rest of the Bible speaks about that, a wisdom from God, a wisdom that is so different to the wisdom that humanity would come up with. As the Apostle Paul writes to the Christians in Corinth, which is a town in Greece in the first century, he writes to them about this wisdom from God and people's reaction to it. He begins by quoting a part of the Old Testament. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 19, he quotes from the prophet Isaiah in the Old Testament, where God says, "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world?" What he's saying is that God has decided that in our wisdom, scholarship, philosophy, etc., we will not find the answer or the great secret. God has chosen that we won't work it out ourselves, we'll need to be shown. And what is it that we need to be shown? Well, he continues, verse 21, "For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe." Now notice he doesn't say that preaching is foolishness. You may think it is, but that's not what he's saying. He's saying it's the foolishness of what was preached. It's the message. There is a message that's preached to people, a message that will come to people, and for those who believe it, they will be saved. If you like, rescued from the consequences of walking away from God. So God has decided the way people will be rescued is to believe this message that they'll be told. And what is the message? Verse 22. I should just say, the way the first century Jewish world saw the world, you're either a Jew or a Gentile. And often the Gentiles were simply referred to as Greeks. So you're a Jew or a Greek, or a Jew or a Gentile. It's just a different way that they spoke about the world. Now, Paul says here, verse 22, Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom. So two ways of, you know, how do you find the wisdom? To see a great sign from heaven or to work it out yourself through philosophy? He says, no, that's not what God's arranged. He says, verse 23, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. See what he's saying? The secret to life, the way to find life beyond, like the life that doesn't end in the grave, life into eternity, the way to be right with God, the way to be saved from all of this is through a crucified Jewish carpenter. And he says that message is a stumbling block. The word means it's an offence. It's offensive to Jews, he says, in the first century, and it's foolishness to the philosophically minded Greeks. It's offensive or it's foolish, or, verse 24, he says, but to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, in other words, to those that God gives understanding to, calls to himself, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Where do you find the answer to life, the power and wisdom of God? In the person of Jesus, in his crucifixion. Isn't that strange? It's not the way the wisdom of our world would point. So here's a question for you today. Will your wisdom and learning, and if you didn't want to think about life, you wouldn't be here. Right? Is your wisdom and learning, will it finish in the grave, or will you listen to God's wisdom in Jesus and find life?